Hey, I'm Monday.
And I'm Tom.
And this is our Ulysses Book Club.
Join us as each month we navigate the 20th century's most famously complex classic, one chapter at a time.
As longtime fans of James Joyce, we're excited to chat with you about what makes Ulysses a modernist masterpiece.
Ineluctable modality of the visible, the inescapable nature of that which can be seen. Seaspawn and Seera, the nearing tide, that rusty boot, snot green, blue silver, rust. Shut your eyes and see. Has all vanished since. If I open and I'm forever in the black? No, they're all the time without me. I mustn't forget DC's letter for the press. And after the ship, Mulligan and Haynes, half past 12. By the way, go easy with that money like a good young imbecile. Yes, I must.
And we are once again in the State Library of Victoria, ready to talk about Ulysses Monday. I'm very excited to talk about this third chapter.
Yeah, so am I. This is a fun chapter. However, it's something that we're building up to a bit, but Proteus is definitely that moment when readers kind of go, oh, fuck. Like, this is what people were talking about.
Yeah, this is the Ulysses that a lot of people switch off when they get to. I can totally understand that. I think we're biased because we both love this chapter a lot.
Yes.
But I totally get it. Yeah, Virginia Woolf, this is when she tapped out. When she called it the work of an undergraduate scratching at his pimples, I think was the phrase that she used.
Brutal.
Yeah. I mean, she's sort of, I don't know, not too wrong either. That's sort of, I get it, you know. But yeah, this is a tough chapter. When you first read this, is this where you, did you stop or stumble here or?
Oh God, I can't remember now.
Yeah, it's a bit hard.
I think maybe not so much. I think I probably kept going. Mm-hmm. However, I took in a lot less.
Yeah.
And I don't think I realized till a long time later that this chapter actually not that much happens.
Yes, that's
like,
right.
It's sort of, I think Stephen's going for a walk on the beach and it's what the thoughts that are happening in his head.
Yeah.
And that's it.
No, we sort of are introduced to like more some of the motifs and ideas that are going to come up in other bits of Ulysses. It's like for it's symbolic plot development, I guess, but it's not really like plot development at all. No,
completely. And also, in a book this big in the sense, there's so many themes and you're going to miss them anyway. And I think that's the thing about this chapter. Even rereading it for this, there's parts that I felt like I had never read before.
I constantly open up this chapter and go, I do not remember this bit.
I don't remember this. And there's bits you do remember. I remember poor dog's body's body.
Yes.
But other parts, I'm like, I don't know, if I just fell into a coma while I was reading this part. Mm-hmm. So I think what we're trying to say is be kind to yourself if you're struggling with
exactly.
this.
Exactly. This is the perfect place to drag out a wiki summary, to look at things online. This is the place where if you are unsure about certain sections, and we're not going to be able to cover the full aspects of it. So I did try to write down a plot summary of this. I think I've got it. Luckily, it's nice and simple.
The stage is yours.
All right, here we go. This is what I wrote. The third chapter, Proteus, is the last one from Stephen's perspective for a while. He wanders along the beach of Sandymount as he heads towards Dublin city centre, and his mind wanders, as the text does as well. The language is quite dense, but the narrative quite simple. He reflects on family, he writes a poem, he watches a dog pee, he picks his nose and leaves his snot on a rock. We then leave him for a bit. That's my short little summary of what happens.
Ta-da!
Yeah. Yet in this chapter, we see some of the most insane writing in the 20th century. So that bit I didn't specifically go into.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's some parts of literature as well as there's a lot to be said for how you say something, not necessarily what you say to. From a Odyssey perspective, Proteus – who is Proteus? So Proteus is an early god of the seas and rivers. So, you know, you know the gods from the Odyssey and the Iliad, you know, the Greek Parthenon of gods. You say, is that what you say?
Parthenon? Yeah.
Pantheon?
Yeah.
Parthenon.
Pantheon.
The Greek pantheon.
We'll get there.
The Greek building of gods. he's an earlier god and a little like less powerful god now. Anyway, I think he has the gift of foresight or something like that. So basically, I'm pretty sure after the Odyssey, Menelaus is talking to Telemachus, and that he had sort of got stuck on this island here on his journey home from the war. He'd learned from Proteus's daughter that if he could capture her father, he could force him to reveal which of the gods he had offended and how he could give them some sort of offerings and return home. So Proteus sort of emerges from the sea to sleep with his colony of seals, and Menelaus successfully grabs him. And like the whole time Proteus is like changing into all these other animals and water. And the idea is that, like, you're trying to catch a shapeshifter or just trying to catch water in general, but he's able to do it, and he holds on to him. And then he, you know, finds out a bunch of stuff and gets to go home. Like, that's the really, really short version. And so that's kind of reflected in this chapter. Like, things jump around everywhere, because really what's happening is he's thinking about, you know, his life and where he's going to go to next. And there's all these different shape-shifting thoughts, and he's just trying to grasp onto it and find out where he's going, very much like how Menelaus is trying to grab onto this seal water god. So it's like the chaos of it is intentional as well. And I think also maybe potentially some of it is artificial, and to that point, not super important, because it's part of the artifice of the situation.
Yeah, that's a great word to use too, artifice. I feel like, yeah, it's the written equivalent of trying to catch jelly in your hands or whatever. You know, it's constantly, every time you try to grab meaning out of it, it slips out and turns into a joke, or it slips out of a joke and turns into an extremely serious existentialist thought. It's just constantly shifting in tone and attitude and symbol, and it makes it very hard to read. But also in a godlike way, right? It says some really important, powerful things too.
Oh, of course.
I was writing, I remember I wrote down some questions, and one of my questions that I wrote down are all Joyce's characters sex freaks? And when you said that Proteus is coming out to sleep with his colony of seals, I'm like, okay, maybe I actually see, because there's a lot of undercurrents of sexual imagery that we haven't really gotten in previous chapters as well. This is a bit of a shift in that way too.
Yeah, they're definitely sex freaks though.
Oh yeah, 100%. Oh, we'll get to that. But yeah, I sort of feel like this is a chapter that is putting you primarily in the mind of a person, and just like anyone else's mind, it's impossible to fully pass what is being thought of. It's hard to even keep track of your own thoughts when they run, let alone someone who you don't know, who has a history and collection of feelings and thoughts that we can't, as a reader, fully imagine.
Of course, how can you make sense of that? You know, when you're thinking and suddenly like, why did I think of this thing? How did I get there? The leaps that your mind makes between different topics, and even how it can hold different thoughts at once. Like right now we're talking, I'm focused on you, but there's parts of my brain that are still sort of like touching other ideas slightly on the side.
Not only that, but our bodies are like regulating at the same time, where our brains are doing so many things at once. I wrote down, inescapable nature of the body, ? Is another like note I made during this. And when we get to the beginning of the chapter, I feel like that is very much how the whole thing begins, this idea that like our minds are amazing, godlike, flittery things, but they're also inescapable, you know, to some extent. And that can be existentially quite scary too. Maybe it's better if we jump in.
Let's jump in. We
should make a note about the way we're going to approach this chapter, is instead of sort of just stepping through each bit, because this is such a wishy-washy, flitty chapter, it's going to be impossible to sort of step through it bit by bit. So instead, we've sort of grabbed our favorite moments from it, and we might jump from person to person. The reason I thought to mention this in particular is because I was reading Read Joyce, which is Anthony Burgess's big obsessive love letter to James Joyce. And Anthony Burgess actually treats Ulysses as a novel, like how we're about to treat this chapter. He specifically noted that he likes to, whenever he's lost, open up Ulysses to a random page and just read it and see. It's almost like it's giving him a fortune or something. And this chapter probably works best if we jump in to the bits we love the most just open up and see what happens rather than just trying to grab the whole thing.
I love that. Should we jump in?
Let's jump in.
open hallway. Street of Harlots. Remember, Harun al-Rashid. I'm almost in it. A man led me, spoke.
Come.
I was not afraid. The melon he had, he held against my face, smiled.
Come.
Cream fruit smell.
That is the rule. Red carpet spread. You will see.
Dog.
I'll let you start.
All right. Well, the first sentence is...
we love the first sentence. This is where... I know we said we were going to choose, but actually...
The first sentence. Yeah, it's where you lose. It's where everyone gets lost, basically. And it's definitely taken me a long time to fully... Actually, Monday, I feel like, can you read it for me? Can you give me the first maybe two sentences or maybe?
Ineluctable modality of the visible, at least that if no more, though through my eyes, signatures of all things I am here to read, sea spawn and sea rack, the nearing tide, that rusty boot, snot green, blue silver, rust, coloured signs.
And we just continue from there into...
What did I just
concept.
Say?
Yeah, and it's definitely ineluctable. I remember when I first read this book, had to look up what that word meant. Modality, had to look up what that word meant.
Definitely.
And so on. And it continues on that way. But I'm here ready to present my sort of interpretation of what we've got here. So we begin without yet fully knowing where we are. With Stephen's eyes closed and opening on a beach. And he is considering, which once I went and looked it up, Aristotle's concept of the world. So Aristotle said that an object's colour allows us to see it or not see it. And we see here Stephen opening and closing his eyes and commenting on the colour of things that he sees around him on the beach. We've got like snot green, blue silver, rust. He's mentioning these sort of things. But in a bigger sort of point, the ineluctable modality of the visible, the things we see in front of us are impossible to fully comprehend in their entirety. You know, Plato style, there are perfect versions of these things existing somewhere else, and we see only what's reflected into our eyes. So if we look at that ineluctable modality of the visible, what that that term means, I think what we're trying to get out of it is we cannot... Just like Proteus is a slippery god that Menelaus can't grab onto, the world around us when we open our eyes and look at it is not the world as it is to everybody. Like in our own heads, we interpret the world. We are given a different world to look at.
Yeah. And I think the interesting part is that he's, you know, exploring that aspect of the philosophy and then jumps into signature of all things, which is a far more modern way of thinking about God and how God speaks to us through his creations. So there's this argument around interpretation and sight, but then also the truth of the objects to some degree as well.
Yeah, that there is a signature to them.
That there is a signature to them that God has put in there.
Mm.
Whether the message is personal or not.
Yeah, and he goes on to sort of add bodies as well, but he adds in bodies. And that's where I remember I wrote down that inescapable nature of the body. The artist wants to see the truth in everything, and he is an artist. He's a poet. He's a writer. The artist wants to reveal the truth through art, but bodies restrict that to some extent. You can only see the ineluctable modality of the visible. You can only see what you're given.
Rolls off the tongue, doesn't it?
I've read it enough times now where I'm like, I'm going to remember this. But this whole idea of, you know, the artist trying to reveal truth, if you think about what the chapter is, it's Joyce writing, trying to emulate what the mind does when you're thinking. It's like an impossible task, isn't it? Like, yes. Our brain is in, we are not able to write down what our brain is able to do. And I feel like Stephen is struggling with how to go forward in his art to some extent here as well. How do I reveal truth through the things that I do if I can't even see the truth? My body doesn't allow me to fully like comprehend the universe.
Yeah, I think the failure is on both sides too. Joyce can't write down what happens in our minds.
Mm.
And from whatever he's tried to write down, the shadow of thought that he's tried to write down, we can't turn that back into the thoughts in our mind either.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we're trying to process something and your mind is creating thoughts.
Yeah. And we see even in the second little paragraph there, Stephen's mind is jumping around a lot. He can't stick on one thing. Sometimes he closes his eyes to try and calm his mind a little bit. But then he says, the ineluctable modality of the audible. The things you hear aren't fully the things you hear. And he has this like little existential panic attack where he realizes that like to some extent your body stops you from fully contemplating the universe. He's having a big moment here, standing almost completely still on a beach, closing and unclosing his eyes or opening his eyes.
Completely bound by your physical experience, really.
Yeah. And I like that question he asks himself. Am I walking into eternity along Sandy Mount Strand? And he follows up this powerful, you know, existential question with the sound he's making. Crush, crack, crick, crick. That's him walking along the beach. And for me, I think that really summarizes this chapter where we go from really, really serious thoughts deeply inside the mind of our character suddenly to like the sound of the foot on the sand, you know. We go from the deep thought to the physical reality to some extent.
Well, yeah, it's reality intruding back in to what he's doing in his mind because he's looking deeply inside himself when he's having these conversations.
Yeah.
And then the sound of the shells or a dog's bark or the wind, it pulls him back to the physical.
Stephen Dedalus, you will never be a saint. You were awfully holy, weren't you? You prayed to the devil in Serpentine Avenue that the fubsy widow in front might lift her clothes still more from the wet street, on the top of the Hoth tram alone, crying to the rain. Naked women! Now what about that, eh? What about what? What else were they invented for?
Okay, jumping into the next part that we like, which really straight in, I'll read this for you. Open your eyes now. I will. One moment. Has all vanished since? If I open and am forever in the black adiaphane. Buster. I will see if I can see. See now. There all the time without you and ever shall be. World without end. I just love that.
There are sections of this that it does not matter at all what is really being said. It's just beautiful to listen to. I love that about this chapter.
And I think it's a universal feeling, that idea. Imagine if you go to sleep and you don't wake up, or you shut your eyes and you never open them again. And it doesn't matter what he's doing in the present or where he is or being in a beach in Dublin. It's such a universal feeling that he's captured.
Yeah.
And I think they're the most important parts, the themes that you were talking about before, to grasp onto here.
Yeah. Even just if when his eyes are closed, what if I am forever in the black? That's existentialist shit that we've all probably had at least some point. I say probably, I have. a fearful spike through you of, is that what non-existence is?
Of course. One of my greatest fears is going under anesthetic.
Oh, yeah.
Because, at least my experience of it, you're suddenly awake and, you know, you're counting down, and then before you count down, like, it's gone, right? And you're waking up and it's not like dreaming. There's nothing in between.
Yeah.
And, you know, my fear is that's what death is like. Mm. It's like that total lack of awareness when through most other things you have something. Even people in comas have levels of awareness often. Yeah. It's scary.
And it's understandable. There is a way now we can connect to Stephen in that way. He's having that moment, that existential panic.
Mm.
Yeah. There's a little section underneath just at the end of the next paragraph there that for me outlines very much when you do break down what everything means, how clever some of this stuff is. So I'm just going to read you a little bit and then take you through that little section of how it all works. So there is a little section here where he says, "Will you be as gods? Gaze in your Amphalos. Hello, Kinch here. Put me onto Edenville. Aleph Alpha 001. Spouse and helpmate of Adam Cadman. Heva, naked Eve. She had no navel. Gaze." This little section sounds sort of like words without meaning. But taking it sentence by sentence, it's actually saying something really, it's melding through different ideas. So would you be as gods, gaze in your Amphalos? That's Amphalos is like the navel of the world where you navel gaze. So if you would be as gods, can you like tell what's going to happen in the future, navel gaze? And then almost like he's picking up the phone, he says, "Hello, Kinch here." Kinch being his nickname for himself. It's almost saying if the gods called you, what would you say, jokingly? Then he says, "Put me onto Edenville," like paradise through the suburbs, you know, put me onto one of the suburbs. And then the number that he uses to collect call is Aleph, Jewish god, Alpha, Greek god, Naught, which is nothingness, and One, which is the Christian god. The number that when that collects through to the phone, he gets onto Adam Cadman. Adam Cadman, that's like the Greek and the Abrahamic religions' first person. And Heva, naked Eve, who had no navel to gaze with. And we're back at the start of the thing again. Mm. Now, this is like one little section, but even just like the play with words that he's having here is so clever and crazy, but he's not even really saying anything. He's just making a joke about if you navel gaze, you're making a collect call to the future. And that stuck out to me as one of my favorite little bits, just because it's so weird.
It's so funny. I love this, and I hadn't really thought of it that way before, because what I really like about this bit is what's prompted it. And earlier, you know, in the paragraph prior, he sees a midwife. And so he suddenly starts thinking about Eve, who wouldn't have had a midwife because Eve and Adam, you know, were the first people when they had their children. And just those little tiny bits, I think, perfectly capture how you can see someone that you know has this sort of job and suddenly you're talking about somebody who could never have had a midwife.
Yes. And the next sentence is belly without blemish, which even links to what you said before, world without end, belly without blemish.
Yeah, and the first person, she wasn't born, Eve, they were made. So, and then, of course, he jumps into womb of sin and wombed in sin darkness. And, you know, there's a little bit more in the rest of this. I think Joyce can be unkind to women.
Yes. It's weird too, because he was sort of giving women a lot of freedom in his text that women were not offered in modernist texts by a lot of modernists, not by all of them, but he really does shit on their choices a lot. Sometimes I don't know whether he is like making fun of the way that Christian concepts demonize women, and sometimes I'm like, are you also doing this?
I think he's doing both.
Yeah.
What's the name of the play that we went and saw together?
Exiles.
Exiles. Yeah. We saw Exiles.
That's Joyce's only play that he ever wrote, yeah.
And, you know, it's looking at couples that, you know, open, or, you know, there's polyamory to some degree. Well, there's more free love and more thoughts around free love and what it means to give, you know, your body and yourself and what that means to other people. And so he does explore that, and it feels very modern in a lot of ways, particularly when we think about, you know, where we live in Melbourne and the relationships we see with our friends. But I felt even in that there was, you know, an unkindness towards the female characters.
Like that they were sort of, there was a judgment. Maybe it wasn't even, there's less chance of redemption.
They have less agency.
Yeah, that's a good
point. So much of it's told, I think, from the men's perspective, and, you know, so much centers around their careers and then what they do with this and the impact that it has on them. And I think he wants to explore women, but they're still very much passengers of the plot.
Yeah.
That's how it felt.
Even just that phrase you just said, the womb of sin, which is what he comes back to a fair bit, at least in this little section here. It's like, is it the if it's the womb of sin, then it belongs to the woman. Like, yes. But she didn't commit the sin. But his phrasing, that's why I'm not sure whether he's making fun of Christianity for blaming all women for what happened with Eve. Is he making fun of that? Or is he sort of saying, wombed in sin, darkness, I was too, in the next little section?
I know, that's hard because he's not exactly fond of his mother.
Yeah, he has a complicated relationship.
I do think part of it is definitely just playing on the concepts. I mean, he plays on so many concepts throughout this entire book. He pulls from different philosophers, different religions. He, as the author, doesn't believe all those things necessarily.
No, that's true. Yeah. And that was the way I took it for the most part, is that whenever he mentions these Christian concepts that place women in that kind of passenger role, I assume he's making fun of it, but that might be me projecting. I'm not sure.
I don't know. I feel like it's pretty safe to like assume men from the early 1900s were mostly sexist.
Yeah, that's probably true. That little section, wombed in sin darkness I was too, made not begotten, by them, the man with my voice and my eyes and a ghost woman with ashes on her breath, they clasped and sundered, did the coupler's will. It's a very, you don't want to think about your parents having sex and making you, but he is taking potshots at his dad, who has his voice and eyes, but he's begotten not, you know what I mean? Like a maid not begotten, like I do not want to be my dad, but I have his eyes and voice. And his mum, who's dead already almost, made of ashes, a ghost woman. Like she has died recently, but yeah, I don't know. It seems like he hates both of them. And
he's not very happy.
Yeah.
But then just moving on slightly, suddenly, I mustn't forget his letter to the press.
Yeah.
You know, you're just there and you're daydreaming and you're thinking your thoughts and you're looking at nature and suddenly you remember that, you know, you need to hang out the washing or that your boss asked you to put this meeting in. He doesn't even say who he is. I mean, it's Deasy, we know that. Yeah, but yeah. Just like that, you know, when so much is philosophical and looking inwards, and then this line, oh, I mustn't forget this letter to the press.
Yeah, it's pretty funny, isn't it? That, for me, is one of the most relatable aspects of the structure of this.
Yes.
Yeah. The fact that he is constantly interrupted by his own mind about the stuff that he's meant to do that day.
Yeah. Which I also think is good as a reader. I actually found reading this chapter, they're the bits that would ground me. I'm like, okay, I know what's happening again now.
Yeah. And that straight after that, he actually, his pace slackened and we actually get like a third person perspective for the first time in a while. It's been jumping between first person and third person in the pronouns that it's using, but we suddenly get his pace slackened here. And that here is like a one word sentence, and he's almost like stops on the beach. Am I going to Aunt Sarah's or not? So now he's like, okay, hang on a sec, I'm getting distracted. Where am I actually going? And we finally get a little bit of like plot structure to this thing.
The perspective is ever changing. Another thing that just makes it quite difficult to read.
Yeah, absolutely. Before we go on to the next little bit, I just really love the way he describes the waves. It's just a beautiful little thing. He says, they are coming, waves, the white-maned seahorses, champing, bright wind-bridled, the steeds of Manan. It's just like, I can see it in my mind. Maybe it's because we're both Lord of the Rings fans.
I know, that's what I was thinking.
That's it, you know.
The movie on the river, the white horses.
And waves and horses, it is such a good symbolic connection. I don't know, like it feels right, feels very... platonic, like that's what waves are, you know?
Yeah.
I was young. Books you were going to write with letters for titles. Have you read his F? Oh, yes. But I prefer Q. Yes, but W is wonderful. Oh, yes, W. Remember your epiphanies on green oval leaves? Deeply deep copies to be sent if you died to all the great libraries in the world. And Paris. Just say in the most natural tone... when I was in Paris.
Stephen starts thinking about his family a bit more throughout these pages as well. It's hard for... he speaks pretty badly about his family generally. They sort of phrases them like drunkards and idiots.
And idiots. I get like a hint of intellectual superior
definitely
vibes.
And for at least a page or two, he is... yeah, pretty intellectually shitting on his family
yeah.
and where he's come from. And it, for me, it comes from that begotten, not made, or made, not begotten thing where he feels like the black sheep of his family, who are all sort of regular Irish, which we come back to later on with.
I know. Well, yeah. I mean, the resentful academic child, you know, it's kind of a trope for a reason, right?
Yeah. When he fully like looks at his family from a big perspective, he uses the phrase houses of decay, mine, his and all. And I think he's like with that, he's linking his own family's, his dislike of his own family to his dislike of the Irish people in general and his dislike of nationalism and his dislike of like all of us pretending that our family means something. We're all houses of decay. The Christian church is a house of decay. The English state is a house of decay. You know, it's very nihilistic. I feel like he connects all that. But what I love is that at the bottom of that sort of section, he starts turning that on himself and he starts making fun to some extent of his own intellectual superiority. He realized,
he's self-aware, at
yeah.
least.
especially because right in the middle of making fun of these things, he starts doing something that we're going to come to later on, which is perving on women on top of the Howth tram alone, crying to the rain, naked women. What about that, eh? What about what? What else were they invented for?
See, this is what I mean. Do you take it back?
I do. Well, I mean, I agree, yeah. This is Stephen's actual thought.
Yeah.
He definitely has a problem with women.
Well, I think, yeah, I think you can see it with often how they come in is that, you know, it was in the first chapter, he sees the milk way, the milk lady's breasts, yeah. her shrunken paps, yeah. I believe he calls them.
That's right.
It's all about the glimpses that he has of women's flesh.
Yeah.
That's sent his mind spiraling.
Yeah.
It just shows you that, you know, the way that male characters are grounded and explained and how he relates to them, like him, the character, not the author, versus how he sees female characters.
And he does follow that up, I will say, by shitting on himself for exactly those thoughts. Cousin Stephen, you will never be a saint. You know, you were awfully holy, weren't you? Prayed to the Blessed Virgin, you might not have a red nose. Like he's looking at from the kid onward. He believed in all that Christian stuff. But you will never be a saint, Stephen.
Yeah, and I think that's funny too. Is that still part of his inability to escape from the church and guilt?
Mm. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
The idea of that he just wishes he was doing the right thing, or that guilt that you feel and not being able to cleanse yourself of it
yeah.
because you've been told it's the wrong thing to covet women in that way.
Yeah. I wrote down here, you call yourself cultured, but all you want to see is women naked. You call yourself all about the art, but you just focus on how you look to other people.
Yeah.
And I think he is having that realization too. But, yeah, I agree. I think culturally it's also a Christian thing, isn't it, to look back at yourself and cut yourself down.
Completely. And I think, you know, why even through that self-critique and analysis, it's still grounded in himself though and the sort of person he wants to be. And it's not necessarily about how, oh, well, it's not wise for women to have people view them that way.
Mm.
Any self-reflection is still, he's very self-obsessed, but as we probably all are in our own thoughts.
I definitely think that's what Joyce is trying to say in
yeah.
this moment.
I think about myself a lot.
Well, I'll read you a little
no judgment.
Section here about how he thinks of himself. So this is him remembering himself from a young age where he was an artist from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
He says, reading 2 pages a piece of 7 books every night, eh? I was young. You bowed to yourself in the mirror, stepping forward to applause earnestly, striking face. Hooray for the goddamned idiot. Hooray. No one saw. Tell no one. Books you were going to write with letters for titles. Have you read his F? Oh, yes, but I prefer his Q. Q, yes. Oh, but his W is wonderful. Oh, yes, W. Remember your epiphanies on green oval leaves? Deeply deep. Copies to be sent if you died to all the great libraries of the world, including Alexandria. Someone was to read them there after a few thousand years. You know what I mean? Like he's making fun of himself for his obsession with how he looks as an artist to everybody else.
I know, but don't we all do that to ourselves as children?
Oh, yeah.
You may you know this, my grandmother passed away recently, and some of the things my parents brought over to my house last night were cards and letters that I had written her. And I read cards from when I was a child or letters that I used to post her. I was mortified. I was mortified at the things that I said. Writing about books that I'd read and my opinions of them. It was cringeworthy and incredibly embarrassed. And it wouldn't have been at her at the time because I was a kid and it was very cute. But I feel like even that theory that you have is very universal of that unbridled optimism you can have as a child about what you want to do and your gifts.
Mm.
And, you can role play that in the safety of your room and you can dream big and dare because your life isn't really set in front of you yet. And I think the older that we get, the more doors close. I remember a couple of years ago, a friend was telling me about how she used to be a dancer on cruise ships. And then afterwards I was like feeling kind of weird and funny. And I was thinking to myself, it's like, I will never like work on a cruise ship. I don't want to work on a cruise ship, but I have a career that I'm very happy with. And that was never something I wanted to do, but it's the sort of thing that you do when you're 24. And, at the time when you're 32, you don't go and, I'm not going to change my career to go and work on a cruise ship. And I think this captures that too, that like hope and optimism that you can have when you're young. And then as you get older, most people's doors start to close and the reality of your situation and your skills and whether that's the skills that you have are desired in the capitalist society and there's ways for you to profit and be successful in those or not. And that's kind of the reality that he's coming to as well, that, even though he's writing these quippy little things that, old mate wants to pay him for, he's still not actually doing any of those things that he dreamed of.
Mm.
And he's still sort of subsisting in a way as like the educated lower middle class.
Yeah. I think it's when he steps forward and remembers his 20s, his early 20s when he moved to Paris, I think it's exactly what you're saying there about these like even looking forward, what you do in your 20s when you're looking back on that feels a little bit silly as well. So he remembers in this little section over the page, he remembers what it was like for him when he moved to Paris to get away from all of his Irish family who don't get what it's like to be a literary person. And in this little section...
Oh my God, sorry. As a kid that moved to the city to go to university, like from the country, can relate.
I love this and I'll read it in a sec, but it's good to know what it is before you read it. Mm-hmm. He's remembering when he was in Paris in his 20s and because he was reading all types of literature that you shouldn't be reading, he was waiting and waiting to get arrested in Paris. But he's walking around like a very fancy, fine, literary person. And he thinks he's about to get shot or arrested on the street. And this is what he says. Proudly walking. Whom were you trying to walk like? Forget. A dispossessed. With mother's money order, 8 shillings, the banging door of the post office slammed in your face by the usher. Hunger toothache. En quelle deux minutes. Look clock. Must get. Ferme. Hired dog. Shoot him to bloody bits with a bang shotgun. Bits man splattered. Walls all brass buttons. Bits all crack in place. Clack back. Not hurt? Oh, that's right. Shake hands. See what I meant, see? Oh, that's all right. Shake a shake. Oh, that's all right. And I was reading an interpretation of this, and while he's walking freaked out in Paris, he tries to go to the post office to get a money order from his mum who's sending him money, and he's looking at the clock to see it's 5 o'clock. They shut the door on his face. He bangs on the door to be let in, thinks he's going to get shot, and the guy says, oh, no, I was just, come in, I'm shaking hands, I'm not putting out a revolver. So he's imagining all these like, oh, people are after me, people are trying to stop me, but he's just going to collect a money order from his mum in Paris. Like this idea that he had of what it's like to be an artist in Paris is just getting money from your mum at the post office. And when you bang on the door, do something radical, you think you're going to get shot. I mean, at the end of the day, he's just not as radical as he thinks he is. He thinks he's this like... freedom fighter, but he doesn't care about anything enough to fully be a radical, I think.
Not at all.
Yeah, and it's very I don't know, cute to see him remembering this time when he thought he was edgy, but he wasn't.
I know. And it links back to the start of the chapter about perspective, right? You know, what are you actually seeing? And can you see a truth that God put there? Or, you know, even with your eyes, it's interpretation.
Yes. Yeah. Still a pacifist is what I wrote down at the end, which when we get to Leopold Bloom, we're going to see someone who is proudly a pacifist, proudly someone who does not want fighting, does not want conflict.
But which is very rare at the time too, right? Oh, like definitely. The shame of being a pacifist, from what I understand.
And even when Stephen and Bloom meet near the end of the book, we see that they are connected, but they can't fully connect. And I think Stephen doesn't want to be a pacifist. I think he wants to be. And honestly, this is where I connect with him a little bit. I have pretty progressive beliefs, but I'm also not particularly a good, I don't know, I'm not really good in a conflict, I would say. And I'm always thinking about the contrast between how progressive and radical my beliefs are and to what extent I would enforce them out in the world. Like, would I start a fight with someone? Them? Would I? Yeah. Well, and I laugh at myself, and I think Stephen is doing that here.
And then, dragging my valise across the slimy pier at New Haven, rich booty I brought back, a blue French telegram, mother dying, come home, father. Here, I'm not walking out to the Kish lightship, am I? Turn back, there's the tower. Mulligan has the key. I will not sleep there tonight. After Haynes woke me up last night, I was having that dream again. Same dream, or was it? Wait.
Okay, and then after a little while longer, we get to a bit that I'd just like to read out, which was, he had come near the edge of the sea and wet sand slapped his boots. The new air greeted him, harping in wild nerves, wind of wild air of seeds or brightness. Here I am not walking out to the Kish lightship, am I? He stood suddenly, his feet beginning to sink slowly in the quaking soil. Turn back. And just another grounding moment that this really is just a man walking on the beach by himself, thinking stuff. And now he has got to the end and he is turning around and he is going to walk back. And that's all that's happening.
Yeah, and sometimes he is able to turn that, what he is doing, into something beautifully symbolic, like phrases like, the flood is following me, you know, but that's just the ocean. The waves coming in. And he's able to turn it into something. But yeah, sometimes he is half-assing it. And other times he just, the reality of the world, you know, the ineluctable modality of
the visible.
You can't change the fact that you're in a body on a beach, you know, no matter how galaxy brain your mind is being.
Yeah. And I think the interesting thing about being on the beach is that I'm not sure if the ineluctable modality of the visible applies, because the ocean is so loud. And so you can shut your eyes on the ocean and you could never forget that you're there, unlike other spaces.
I have this happen to me whenever I try and go out into the bush or go out and write, you know, or the beach or something by myself, and I'm going to take my book and read, or I'm going to write something. I always find that it's almost like the landscape is too dramatic for me to, I'm focusing too much on how I look and sit and, you know what I mean?
The art
of the world is too, I think it's meant to be aesthetically powerful and moving, but it's almost like the art of the world is so much more serious and beautiful than I am being here. It's almost like I'm ruining it by being there or something. And I get self-aware, and it actually is harder to be artistic in that space. I don't know. I see that happening to him a little bit, and I have that, I think.
I think so. And I'm not sure for me what reason is going on behind it, but I read a lot. And I've taken a lot of books to the beach, but gun to my head, I don't know if I've ever really read a book on the beach.
Yeah.
So that intent of what you want to do and your ability to execute it in that space because of everything to your side going on. And I think particularly the beach with how loud it is in a really beautiful way.
Yeah.
But it's not something that you can escape and look away from.
And, of course, as Stephen is having these amazing moments, he also is constantly getting distracted by other things that he sees. There is that one line that he has where, a woman and a man, I see her skirties, pinned up, I bet. Again, he is intruding thoughts are sexual as well, not just artistic. And he can't pretend to be this clean, pure, artistic spirit because he's constantly also fantasizing and having sexual urges and impulses too.
Mm. And then other bits break in too. So he sees people out in the water. Mm-hmm. He sees a man with a dog. And then he sees a dog approach a dead dog.
Mm. Yeah. It's funny. Stephen and I both share I don't want to say anything unpopular. I'm not a dog person, right? And dogs like me well enough, but I'm not a huge dog fan, and I don't think Stephen is either. He says, dog of my enemy, you know, terrible meditans. You know, I don't think he's a dog guy.
No. I think that's what brings him out of it as well, right? That he's hyper aware of the dog being there because he's not particularly fond of dogs.
Yeah.
There's a line that he has when the living dog approaches the dead dog. He stopped, sniffed, stalked round it, brother, nosing closer, went round it, sniffing rapidly like a dog all over the dead dog's bedraggled fowl. Dog skull, dog sniff, eyes on the ground, moves to one great goal. Ah, poor dog's body, here lies poor dog's body's body.
Gives me shivers just hearing it spoken as well. It's so, even just that one word sentence, brother, that is really affecting.
Really affecting. Yeah. And then he still has that. But before that, you sense his dislike or discomfort around the dog.
Mm.
And then the next line, this beautiful line, is the dog's owner shouting out, "Tatters, out of that, you mongrel." I just love the clash between the world and his mind.
Yeah. Isn't that, yeah, the reality of the world? Like, you can see things symbolically, but yeah, it's just a mongrel dog sniffing a dead
and
body.
And some guy on the beach is going to start yelling at his pet.
Yeah.
Which you all would, of course.
Yeah.
You'd be like, oi, get away from
it. 100%. Yeah.
Clouding over. Thunderstorm. My cockle hat and staff and my sandal shoe. Where to? To evening lands. My teeth are very bad. Toothless, deadless, the Superman. My handkerchief. Ah, oh, mulling through it. Did I not take it up? No, I didn't. Pick your nose then. Perhaps there's someone.
Stephen turns his face over his shoulder, sees moving through the air high spars of a three-master, her sails braided up on the cross trees, homing upstream, silently moving. A silent ship.
There's another bit I'd like to talk about, and I'm not going to do it in the context of the rest of it because it's purely just because I think it's really beautiful.
Mm.
He has a line, mouth to her kiss. No, must be two of them, glue and well, mouth to her mouth's kiss, which I love. And then it goes into one of my favorite parts of the entire novel, which is his lips lipped and mouthed, fleshless lips of air, mouth to her womb, or looming tomb, his mouth molded, issuing breath, unspeeched, ooh-yah, roar of cataractic planets, globed, blazing, roaring, way away, 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 away. Paper, the banknotes, blossom, old Daisy's letter, here.
Amazing.
I mean
there's so much to say, right? There's so much going on, but what about it is what grabs you?
I think it's the word is susurrus, you know.
Oh, yeah.
When a word sounds like what it means, and he's made up some words there, but they feel so real in the way that he's described it.
I was just thinking about, I mean, look, we come back a lot, especially with Bloom when he remembers him and Molly later on. There's a lot of, the way that Joyce describes mouths kissing.
Yes.
Saliva, like lots of that stuff. There's slobbery glue is like a weird, it's weirdly sexy though.
It's
is that
weirdly
weird
sexy.
Like,
I'm into it.
Yeah, I think it's good. Yeah. Like it's almost like it's written to try and be a little bit gross, but it sort of becomes a little bit sexy as well. I don't know what it is about it. It
feels very real.
Yeah. even like mouth to womb is gross when you think about it, but it is in the context of how it plays. It really is building a case of sexism, though, when I read All Wombing Tomb. When we think about how wombs have been described in this chapter, we've got like, you know, sin and tomb and ashes, and like it's not a good thing, but it's a powerful.
It's just very powerful. And then, you know, and then once again, just adds with old Daisy's letter that he needs to post.
Yeah, remembering. I want it like globed when he's talking about planets. But when he talks about breasts, he talks about globes. And when he talks about saliva, it's globules. Yeah. And you know what I mean? Like there's all the, it's linked. It's all linked together, weirdly.
I also think though, and that's why I love reading this book out loud. I feel like, I would love to be corrected, but he seems like somebody who would speak as he writes because it feels like so many of these words are heard better than they are read. Like they're beautiful to read, but they're so much more impactful when they're heard. Like I think like globed and globular, they're like great words to say.
I know that his eyesight was rapidly deteriorating through writing this, and I have to assume that that has something to do with the audio aspect of this thing.
Yeah,
it really does suit like audiobooks. I've never actually listened to an audiobook fully of Ulysses, but I feel like I should.
I've actually never listened to an audiobook.
Really? That's a huge thing to drop in the middle.
I know. Sorry. I won't let us distract it. We can pick it up later, but no, I haven't.
Wow. Okay. We need to have this discussion later on. But no, I'm more of a reader than an audiobooker, but I've definitely been sold on some very good ones. And I think this would work quite well if I'll have to have a listen.
Should we have been doing that podcast the whole
maybe
time?
That's what we should just be reading it every time. Just after that little section where he bends over to a far table of rock and scribbled words, he starts then sitting on a rock and thinking a little bit more. But Stephen is now like fully letting his mind free, and sitting over this rock, he finally like fully lets go, and all of his fears and existential imagination, his crises, his panic, I feel like all comes out in this little section, which I'll read here. His shadow lay over the rocks as he bent, ending. Why not endless till the farthest star? Darkly they are there behind this light, darkness shining in the brightness, delta of Cassiopeia, worlds. He sits there with his auger's rod of ash in borrowed sandals, by day beside a livid sea, unbeheld, in violet night, walking beneath a rain of uncouth stars. I throw this ended shadow from me, man-shape ineluctable, call it back. Endless would it be mine, form of my form? Who watches me here? Who ever, anywhere, will read these written words? Signs on a white field, somewhere, to someone, in your flutiest voice. It's, you know,
uncouth stars.
Yeah.
That is great.
So good. And it's it's a few things, right? It's the artist having the full crisis of what is it to make art? Whoever anywhere will read these written words. Like even from Joyce's own perspective, by the time you're this deep into this chapter, has everyone given up? Like is anyone reading this anymore?
Statistically, maybe yes.
It's very possible.
Sorry, as in yes, I've given up. Sorry.
Yeah. But there are so many little bits of it that I love. I think that really deeply fucked me up as an early 20s when I read this. Who watches me here? Whoever anywhere will read these written words. When I was, you know, at university and I'm writing things all the time, you know, I think the first existential crisis you have in your 20s, it feels like that. Is there any point to me even doing anything? Like whoever anywhere will read these written words deeply hit me. But even like somewhere to someone in your flutiest voice is just like sort of how do you sing out into the darkness of the universe? How do you, no matter how fluty your voice is, does it matter?
Yeah. I think all of that is even you know, so neatly encapsulated by the first line. His shadow lay over the rocks as he bent, unending.
Mm.
Why not endless till the further star?
Yeah.
You know, if we think about the Odyssey and these great men and heroes and the idea of, you know, their shadows being cast throughout history, and he is a normal guy and his shadow cuts off and the impact that he has on the world is cut off to basically his small part of himself in the world. It's
and even like the concept signs on a white field, that could be written words on a page, signs on a white field, you know, but it could also be like graves in a, you know what I mean? Like in a graveyard, signs on a white field. It could be rocks on a white beach. You know, it could be like there's so many. He's trying to like, it's artistically connecting the world through these things. But even though the artist is doing important work by connecting all the bits of the world, is anyone even giving a fuck? Like, is anyone even listening?
But then also, he's actually not writing it down. He's thinking it too. That's
true. And he can't write it down.
He can't write it down. And, you know, he has this idea of his greatness that should be read and, but they're just thoughts in his head.
And when we get to his theory of Hamlet, like later on, when he's speaking it out loud, he does a pretty good job of outlining his theory, but it's not that smart either. Like he's also not, he isn't as great. Joyce shows us that he's not really as great as he thinks, but he is a beautiful spirit in his mind. And maybe that is like part of the whole point of Ulysses, that everyone is living an odyssey every day. Every one of us in our minds is as beautifully, you know, artistic.
Well, our journey is our journey.
Yeah, right? And we just can't write it down. And there is this almost like, you know, I hate saying like an orgasm of moment, like, you know, but it is. It builds up to this big climax of, you know, all these beautiful imagery, a veil of space with colored emblems hatched on its field, like all these bits. And then at the end of that little passage, suddenly he says, and I'll just read this little section out, hold hard, colored on a flat. Yes, that's right. Flat I see. Then think distance, near, far, flat I see, east, back. Ah, see now. Falls back suddenly, frozen in stereoscope. Click does the trick. You find my words dark. Darkness is in our souls. Do you not think? Flutia. Our souls, shame wounded by our sins, cling to us yet more. A woman to her lover clinging, the more, the more. So it's almost like at the end of this whole thing, he's like, hang on. It's almost like he's drafting what he's going to write. Hold back, hold. And then I'm like, I'm going too crazy. Hold back. Okay. Blah, blah, blah. No, that's too dark. Flutia, flutia, flutia. And then he has that last line, which is truly like a top Joyce line, that our souls, shame wounded by our sins, cling to us yet more. A woman to her lover clinging, the more, the more. I don't know, like our guilt clings to us with our art. I don't know. What do you, I'm blocked by it almost, but maybe our souls are too scarred by our sins to leave our bodies ever, you know, like we're too connected to the world, the reality of the world, to fully like galaxy brain out there clinging like a lover to the darkness in us. And then he goes straight from that into leering at women again. So it sort of destroys the whole moment of it. But maybe that's it. Just a moment of greatness, then back to the real world.
Well, just, I wanted to just go back there because I feel like there was something you said before. you were saying something about, you know, like the point of Joyce is just trying to write this story of this guy who's trying to live this life and, you know, he wants to write something to immortalize himself, right?
That's what you said.
And I think that's really interesting though, because if you compare it to the Odyssey or the Iliad, those people weren't writing their own stories. Yeah. The idea was that Homer is writing the stories, you know, no one knows anything about them or, you know, the author is actually kind of anonymous in a way.
Yeah.
And instead, Joyce is trying to do the opposite. He's, you know, in our culture, the one who's actually famous, and he's trying to immortalize these normal people's lives. Like, I think it's less about Stephen wanting to write this all down and more about the fact that Joyce is going to the effort to do it for such a normal person.
Right.
Because that's my thoughts on it.
No, I like it. That's a really, it's funny we both had those two different thoughts, but I like that. Yeah. And maybe this is then the process of turning the galaxiness of our minds into something real and everyday. I don't know. Anyway, let's move on. I think you had some good stuff about the end as well.
Oh, well,
we're pretty close, but no, if you've got something else to, yeah.
Yeah, I don't even think it's really, you know, good quality stuff or anything like that. I just, you know, I think the end is good for us to look at because it grounds us back in where we actually are, but I think also in the connection to the Odyssey.
We see like threads coming together as well to some extent.
Yeah. And I think these splits are kind of somewhat important to, well, the plot, we'll say.
Yeah.
So I'll just read the last, I think it's the last two sentences. He turned his face over a shoulder, rear a guardant, moving through the air, high spars of a three-master, her sails brailed up on the cross-trees, homing, upstream, silently moving, a silent ship. I think it's great.
And,
you know, if we think about what's happening in the Odyssey, you have Menelaus telling his story about how he got the information from Proteus so he could get back on his journey and move forward. You have Telemachus getting that story from him and him moving on from his journey as well. And then you have Stephen getting to this point where now he's going to step out into the rest of the day after spending an hour walking on the beach.
Mm.
I just like it. I love all the symbolism of the ships and the sea.
Yeah. And maybe there's also like a making a point about Telemachus not being the main character and Stephen not being the main character of this story.
I mean, it's called the Odyssey after Odysseus, right?
Yeah, that's like, exactly right. Yeah. And it's called Ulysses after our who we're going to meet in the next chapter. But I do think we leave Stephen here to go to our next character in a really interesting way. He remembers, just before that last little bit, he remembers the old hag with the yellow teeth. And again, like you were saying before, the milk woman with her, what was it, shrunken paps, you know, yes, the breasts. He's really sort of like imagining women by what they look like. But at this point,
he can only latch on to something he either finds attractive or repulsive, sometimes both at the same time. But that's so far the only grounding we've had in women that he's seen.
Yeah.
Obviously, he thinks about his mother a bit differently, but
that's true.
You know, the women that he's come across or he's thinking about like passingly.
But I think we end with an interesting thing where he remembers this woman with the horrible teeth. And then the next line is, "My teeth are very bad." Why, I wonder, feel that one is going to shells. Ought I go to a dentist, I wonder? With what money? With that money, sorry, that one. And then he, with the last time we see him refer to himself, he says, "Toothless Kinch, the Superman." And I think his teeth, like he is also, he's real. We've gone away off into the galaxy of art and imagination and we've come right back to the real again where his teeth are bad and he is, he does not have good hygiene and he's been imagining himself in this like, you know, thus spoke Zarathustra kind of like, yes, I am a powerful mind.
And everyone will remember me.
Everyone will remember me.
Thousands of years.
Yep. And then he sort of calls himself Toothless Kinch, the Superman. And I think he...
It's very human, isn't
it?
Yeah, realizes, it's a humbling description.
100%. And I think that's why Stephen, as annoyingly... he's an asshole a lot of the time and he's very selfish and self-centered and he's very wanky. But the reason why he stays he's connectable, whatever that word might be, because, I don't know, like he does self-reflect, I think. He just doesn't do it for everything, but he doesn't fully get caught up in thinking that he is the best. He also cuts himself down with reality too, I think.
I know. Do we think that's like true self-reflection though? Or is that just like...
That's the Catholic guilt maybe as well.
And, you know, shame. Like how many
shame
of us...
Shame-winded to our sins, yeah. Our souls, yeah, shame-winded to our sins.
And I think so many of us, what's that thing they used to talk about, like stand someone in front of a mirror and ask them to say what they like and they don't like about themselves. And the list of things that they don't like is really long, right? Yeah. Longer than the things they like. You know, it's so easy for us to find the flaws in ourselves and use them to put us down because it's this idea of not being good enough.
Yeah.
Lack of confidence.
Well, that definitely, I feel, the last image where he says, he laid the dry snot picked from his nostril on the ledge of a rock carefully. For the rest, let look who will. I think his own artist, that's a symbol of his own art that's being left behind, right? Like, it's just snot on a rock at the end of the day. Like, he is cutting himself down quite a lot. And it doesn't feel, you're right, it feels a bit like, all right.
I know. I would love the perspective of, you know, the guy walking his dog on the beach who just sees this, you know, guy kind of wandering on, off in his head, maybe even talking to himself a little bit, terrible teeth and picking his nose and wiping in a rock versus like what's actually happening in Stephen's head and the narrative he's telling himself.
Yeah.
You know, obviously. No judgment. That's all of us, right?
That's right. That's what I mean. I think we come that very ending of that moment is a good reminder that Stephen himself is not particularly.
He's just a normal person. Like all of us.
Yeah, that's right. He's definitely. And Joyce plays him well, I think. It's almost like Joyce is an actor playing this character. Yeah. And I think he plays Stephen really well, probably because Stephen is partly him to some extent.
Partly him. But I love that idea of this is the person we're now immortalizing, which is good too.
And I love that point you made before, the silent ship. You know, that's how we leave him as he looks out on that silent ship.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's where we come to the end of the chapter there. So we're about to leave Stephen behind for a really long time. We don't see him for a while. And we're about to move to our Ulysses character, Leopold Bloom, in the next chapter of Calypso.
Calypso. I'm very excited for Calypso.
Me too. We meet our two main characters here. We meet Molly Bloom and we meet Leopold Bloom for the first time. So looking forward to that. Yeah, I don't think I have anything else to add. Do you have anything to add, Monday?
No, not really.
All right, well, we'll see you all next time when we look at Calypso.
Bye.
Bye.
Audio excerpts from this episode come from the BBC Radio 4 adaptation of the text from Bloom's Day 2012.
Our theme music is Love's Old Sweet Song, composed by James Lennon Malloy and performed by Sun Tzu Speechley.